Well, it's a real privilege to be here. I mean, I couldn't imagine a better audience to try to make a pitch to create some kind of a research initiative. And let me put this in a context the way try so you could understand where it all came from. About 3 or 4 years ago, Carl Landwehr will remember he was on an advisory board for Trust. And he and Jay Lala were sitting in the room at the end of our presentations and bemoaning the fact that Trust was doing fine work, but, you know, it's a catch-up game, and we have to get out of this reactive mode. And that set us thinking within Trust, and the thing about a center is you're supposed to look at bigger problems than any individual would look at. And we were looking towards the possibility of a renewal. And that was the genesis of the thinking that led the Trust Center, which, by the way, Shankar is the director of. I am just the chief scientist. So that led us to think about maybe it was time to build a science-based, and obviously a center-scale operation is the way to do it. And that launched me in my thinking on this, and then I had the first opportunity to speak publicly about it at that Berkeley workshop. So, no surprise, the situation's pretty grim. The defenders are reacting instead of being proactive. Defenses are not being deployed because nobody has a good reason to do that. You can't measure them very well, so you don't get a return on investment. And there's no policy forcing function, no good laws that encourage people to make those investments. And finally, this might be regarded as good and it might be regarded as bad, but the technology base is a moving target. So it's good because it means every 3 or 5 years somebody is deploying new equipment, and that gives you an opportunity to quickly deploy solutions. The bad news is they're often deploying them in new settings, like SCADA, and controlling physical processes, and later you're going to hear from Shankar Sastry, who's been doing work on that. And when you have new application domains, you often have new interesting security problems, so you have to reinvent things. But the fact that these deployment environments is going to change and is changing rapidly sort of is a forcing function to make sure if you want to think about stuff, you think about stuff that's going to transcend those applications, and you try to think more broadly, which starts to sound like what a science would be about. So we've heard this business about a crisis. At least those of you who are old enough have heard this business about a crisis. There was a software crisis in the 60s, and that was the genesis of this discipline called software engineering. It's actually interesting to look back at how that went. So in the 60s, programming was either an art or a craft, and I'll give better definitions for those terms in a bit. But it certainly wasn't a science, and it wasn't all that well engineered. And you read the papers, and they talk about correctness. Well, we now know that if you're talking about correctness, you don't know what you're talking about. We have much more refined ways to say what we expect. And so then they talked about partial and total correctness. And ultimately, it turned out to be about satisfying these properties, and we got this nice underlying structure that properties were going to be safety or liveness, and they were orthogonal, and safety was tied to certain kinds of proofs and liveness to others. So there was a very beautiful structure, a foundation under programming. And, you know, in 30 or 40 years, there is now a much stronger notion of software engineering. But there's been this spin-off science, which people don't talk about, but a science of what programming is about. And it involves programming language semantics, logic, model checking, analysis algorithms, many of which have turned around and changed the way programming is practiced. I am chair of Microsoft's advisory board on security, and I see what they do, and they use automatic model checkers before they ship device drivers. And that's completely out of what you would have imagined possible in the 70s. So we had a 40-year period. Somebody tried to build engineering. They accidentally invented a science base, and it was a maturation process which involved refining what was trying to be built from correctness to something very sophisticated and not being afraid to be mathematical. So you might wonder, why is building a secure system so difficult? And just look at some areas that are, in theory, supposed to help. So there's this argument that people make about Byzantine fault tolerance. After all, the adversary is arbitrary and capricious. Byzantine fault tolerance is about tolerating failures where some components can do arbitrary and capricious things. So if we knew how to build Byzantine fault tolerance systems, which, by the way, we do, haven't we solved the problem? And not unless you look carefully at what's going on. So Byzantine fault tolerance generally involves doing some kind of replication and expecting the system to work even if some of the components are not working. And this works because you make an assumption that components fail independently. And now the probability that too many of them fail is going to be small because you keep multiplying these small probabilities. Well, it turns out that components may fail independently, but they're not attacked independently. If you have several replicas, then the same attack will work against various replicas. And so this underlying assumption, the basic recipe of doing replication, and even if you don't replicate servers but use check codes or any of the other fault tolerance techniques, you're making independence assumptions which actually are not satisfied when you're worried about a sentient adversary. So these also turn out to be good ways to get integrity and availability, but replicating stuff is a terrible way to make something confidential. It makes it easier to have information compromised, not harder. So the traditional view of fault tolerance is not where we're going to find a solution to this problem. And then software engineering, which is based on various formal methods, which I'll call programming methodology, if you look carefully at it, you'll find it's based on some underlying representation of programs and properties and executions. And one common representation scheme is to think in terms of sets of sequences. A sequence corresponds to execution. And there are other things, and they end up encoding this representation. And there's a basic notion of refinement, which says if nothing bad happens in a big set, then nothing bad will happen in a smaller set. And that's true if you define something bad as a particular execution. And that's what this mathematics says. And that turns out to be correct if you're worried about properties like access control and integrity. But it's not correct if you're worried about confidentiality and availability. Right? A set of behaviors in which every value is possible would satisfy confidentiality restrictions. A set of behaviors where X and your salary always equal the same thing would not. And so information flow and confidentiality are not governed by the same notion as refinement, and therefore the standard methods that software engineers use to design programs are based on a foundation that is inappropriate for the kinds of properties that we're interested in when we're building secure systems. And unfortunately, even if you look at work in security, the classic early work, you discover there's something that's pretty well suited for ad hoc delivery, but it's not very principled. Here are the classic security requirements: confidentiality, integrity, and availability. There are nice ways to talk about what you want, except if you look carefully, you can always achieve confidentiality by eliminating availability. Right? If you can't get to the information because it's not available, then obviously confidentiality is supported. At this point, I get upset. Why? Well, they're not orthogonal, so it's not a very useful characterization as a basis for semantics. So it's a good way to talk to your customer and find out what they want, but if you're worried about building a mathematics for programs, this isn't a good way to start. In fact, there are mathematical ways to talk about this. Instead of these properties that people use in software engineering, there's this richer thing called hyperproperties. But the classic notion of security requirements, the CIA stuff, is just not the way one would start building a science base for security. And so all the places you look have made some implicit assumptions, and it turns out that those assumptions are not sound assumptions for building secure systems. So I'm going to argue that we need a science base. I probably don't need to argue it very strongly, given the context. But in so doing, I'm going to use some terms, and I'm going to define those terms not because I want to inflict my definitions on you, but because I want you to understand what I mean when I say those words, and I hope it will be instructive. So you could look at the evolution of a field as it matures, and it could start out as an art. And art is something that you can only do if you have innate abilities and some singular talents. So that was early programming. It's also music and this sort of thing. And we'll call something a craft when it's teachable. And the only way that could happen is because presumably there's a standardized terminology and there's some proven techniques. There's some body to teach. And you could argue that security is there today, right? We have courses. We teach people things that work. We have fairly standardized terminology, and we're at the craft stage. And it's a problem. And so then I've been talking about science, and it turns out there's some controversy about what the definition of a science is if you look around. Up until the 19th century, the term science was used to denote any organized body of knowledge that you got through research. And notice research is an unresolved word there. Starting in the 19th century, the definition seems to have moved to being about acquiring knowledge based on the scientific method. Look later, and some people, so I've recently been reading the Feynman lectures, talk about science being about laws that are predictive. So there are many definitions. Now, the funny thing is, if you are a physicist, all three of these things apply to what you do. But if you're a computer scientist, they don't. Okay. So we have to pick a definition that's going to serve our purposes, and I'm going to pick the characteristic of a science is that it has a way of being predictive. And I pick that because that's what we need. We need a way to anticipate what our systems are going to be like. We need to be proactive. And so we're taking that as the definition of science. It's something you're going to probably debate, if not among yourselves, then with people you talk to about this kind of an initiative. But this is a convenient definition because it pushes us in the right direction, and it actually is one of the definitions people use for science. And then engineering, I would argue, is a craft that's been informed by science. Carl would argue that engineering is informed by science, and science is informed by engineering. This is back to air is human. And that's certainly true. This doesn't preclude that directional, both ways of information exchange. But the important thing is, if we have a science, then we have a chance of going from a craft to engineering, and that's what I think we want to do. So we're looking for a body of laws. Ideally, they're laws that are be general purpose, so they transcend specific systems, attacks and defenses. They ought to be applicable in real settings. Otherwise, it's harder to defend them. It would be nice if they provided some kind of explanatory value. So it makes it easy for me to explain how the world works, gives me insight. Nothing about this says they have to be quantitative. And so you can think about laws that are predictive, how many bits per second leak in a channel. And you can think about laws that are not quantitative, like can you enforce policy P with mechanism M? Logic is an important part of computer science. It's less important in the natural sciences, and a lot of the interesting predictive questions are posed as logical things. Can this imply that? And so I'm not at all surprised that there are non-quantitative laws that ought to be considered part of security science. An analogy that I have made with some success is to think about medical science. And there are two lessons to learn about medical science. First off, it never is going to end, right? Nobody expects medical science to have this magic result that is going to solve medicine. And we have to get people to stop thinking there's going to be a magic result to solve security. This is going to be an ongoing investment that society has to make because the world changes, the attackers change, just like diseases change. And second, the payoff often is surprising. But by understanding the basic mechanisms, when a new disease comes along, we're able to figure out a way to combat it much more rapidly than if we were starting from scratch. So we think of this as a storehouse of basic insights that we can bring and leverage as the world lays itself out, as attackers change, as new deployment settings get created, and so on. I should say something about the role of experimentation, because this is another point that gets debated and was debated quite a bit at the Berkeley workshop. So in natural sciences, experiments are about validating some unknown, checking a law in some unknown reality, right? We don't understand really how the physical world works. We're trying to understand it by positing laws, and then we check them. And now this is why it makes sense for the definition of science for the physical systems to be about the scientific method. The scientific method is about checking things with experiments. You could decide computer science isn't interesting, that anything with the name science in it isn't a science, but I'd like to take computer science as a science. And here, experiments have a very different job. In some cases, we run experiments to learn about realities that are too complicated for us to understand. So you see a lot of work in networking these days where experiments reveal interesting truths about the internet, like it's never ever connected, or most of the traffic is going in a way that's surprising. But there's this other mode of experimental computer science, that's what the field calls it, in which people build prototypes. And the experiment they're doing is they're validating some assumptions. They have some idea, they build a prototype of it, which forces them to pin down all the details. And in so doing, they find the prototype does or doesn't work, or some assumption they made is or isn't realistic. And as a result, it kind of just forces you to face the reality. It's the equivalent of a proof for a systems idea. So that's an experiment, but it's not validating a law. It's forcing you to confront some assumptions that you might have found, you might have ignored. And in computer security, the only thing I would add is, in some sense, all these attacks that get done, that we learn about, are a form of data. They're an interesting form of data for security researchers who are interested in understanding what defenses are useful. So I'm arguing that science is about laws, and the question is, what laws will we have in computer security? And I don't think we know. But I will posit a starting point, and some of the talks you're going to hear from Trust are consistent with this view, and some of it go outside of it, and I think that's great too. But a vocabulary for building these laws seems like it ought to include the notions of policies, attacks, and defenses. And the laws should be about how they're related. Can some defense work against some attacks for a certain policy? Right? Can this mechanism keep things confidential given this class of attacks? And I don't mean attacks like buffer overflow attack. That's a very specific thing. I would like us to be speaking much more abstractly than that. And I don't mean a particular version of Windows. I mean reference monitors or something in that class. So, for example, and to convince you that the science space is more than just theoretical computer science, here are two things that have been done in the past. One is a law that says what execution monitors can enforce. Turns out they can only enforce certain properties. They can enforce the things that software engineering is really good at. So that's a law. It predicts what's going to work and what's not going to work. Somebody comes in and asks you to enforce confidentiality. You could say, no, I can't. Schneider proved the theorem that says I can't. Go away. Let's solve a different problem. No point in trying. But this is a law that actually leads to interesting new defensive technologies. Once you understand the construction in the proof, then you have a way to take any reference monitor and run it inside the code. You don't have to have it in a separate address space, and enforce many more policies than most people thought were feasible. And it also turns out that if you look at the construction, you can see a unification between what people call proof-carrying code and what people call reference monitors. So two previously diverse ideas in security come together because we have established this relation. As another example, it turns out you can prove that the attacks that are prevented by obfuscation, randomizing the address space, turns out to be comparable to the things that strong typing defends against. What's interesting about this is you don't need to know what class of attacks strong typing defends against. You don't have to solve the problem, which is characterizing classes of attacks. It's a reduction result. And so this transcends all attacks, the ones we know and the ones we don't know. And there's this nice correspondence between type systems and obfuscation. This was a result that came out, was motivated by a real problem. We had a system and we were trying to argue how secure it was. And it turns out once you have this, then you can make certain purchasing decisions. Right? If you have source code that C, you could either rewrite it in Java, get strong typing, or you could obfuscate it. And now you know roughly why you should do one or the other. They're comparable, but there are some, there's a probabilistic element to the randomization that is a certainty in strong typing. So in the remaining time, since this is a project review, what I'd like to do is give you another example of a science result, and this is a science result that was developed by my group over the past year, and it will also serve to convey a sense that it's okay to do quantitative stuff, and some surprising consequences of doing quantitative stuff. So what would a science talk be without Lord Kelvin's famous quote, and the only contribution I can make is we ran down where it actually comes from, and this is actually what the quote is. And so I want to tell you about a way to quantify degradation of integrity, and it's going to be interesting, but more interesting to me is it turns out there are qualitative consequences of having run down this definition. So it's pretty well known that confidentiality and integrity are, in a sense, duals. So the picture on the top shows a confidentiality problem. Somehow secret information from the user is leaking to the attacker. And the picture on the bottom shows the dual integrity problem. Somehow untrusted information from the attacker is managing to get to the user, and the user, of course, is going to be confused or confounded by this. And Ken Biba, many years ago, proved mathematically that these two things are duals. We also had on the table theories for reasoning quantitatively about confidentiality leakage. So, in fact, this started with work that Andrew Myers and Mike Clarkson and I did. And this work I'm talking about is with Mike Clarkson. So we had a way to measure how much information was leaking. We had this result on the shelf, which said any confidentiality thing could be turned into an integrity thing, and it was really tempting to turn the crank and come up with a way to measure how much integrity was being compromised. We thought this was one of these quick and easy results, and so here's the duality. We have a definition of leakage, which we're going to, the dual of leakage we'll call contamination. It's the extent to which the attacker's information reaches the user. This, however, doesn't completely explain what's going on. If you look at the picture below, there are other things that the attacker can do to make the user's life miserable. In particular, the attacker could somehow try to suppress information from the user through the program. This is traditional transmission in Shannon-style information theory. Okay. And this is not part of the dual construction of confidentiality and integrity, but it's very much of concern to the user. And so we have worked out the information theory and the measurement for this second aspect, which we call suppression, and it's likely that both contamination and suppression are present, and there's a semantics for programs that lets you infer how much of these things are happening, and so now we have a way to make to quantify the erosion of integrity in terms of information that's contaminated and information that's suppressed. Okay, so there's a point I should make. We started with this. We started with this quantification business, and we stumbled on a qualitative thing. Namely, there's another class of stuff you have to worry about. We need a new name. It's a new phenomena, and you don't have to be quantitative about it. There are just two dimensions to the problem. So here, working in a quantitative thing actually revealed something that was qualitative. Yes?
So I guess I'm a little troubled with your characterization of integrity, because it suggests that the output the user sees is somehow the integrity.
The attacker can tell what output the user is going to see.
Right. And there's plenty of integrity attacks where the attacker would just happily scribble in a blind way, not knowing what it's going to do to the output as long as it changes into something other than it was.
Right.
And so is your theory encompassing?
It encompasses both kinds of things, and it encompasses the fact where if the program itself drew random numbers, and then it would that's pure suppression, actually. And that's a part of the theory as well.
Oh, it's decaused suppression as opposed to
Okay. So, but let me suppose you would ask the successful hostile question, which is because it's a good point. You can think of something that maybe you don't like about the definition. So the proof of the pudding of a definition is that it pays off in some other insights. And so we got that payoff, which gives me some reason to believe we may be on the right thing. So the classifier is a program that reveals some information and suppresses the rest. This is something this community understands really well. And if you think about it, whatever isn't leaked is being suppressed. So there's that simple idea that if you increase the suppression, you'll decrease the leakage. If you decrease the suppression, you increase the leakage. And so there's that funny theorem there. The leakage plus the suppression ought to be a constant. And the constant is actually equal to the information found at the sender side. So that's not slideware. I've been playing fast and loose with mathematics. That's the theorem. And if you replace leakage and suppression with their information theoretic definitions, the plus sign means plus, the equal sign means equal, and we can instantiate the constant. So that leads me to believe that these are kind of nice notions, because they have this very simple theorem that confirms your intuition. Now, what can you do with a law like that? Well, remember, we started out worrying about integrity. But in looking at things, we realize that a place that suppression is used to good effect is in anonymization of statistical databases. And the way they work is they use suppression. Right? They destroy information, and that's why you learn nothing. And so we went back to the literature and looked at three of the important measures that have been proposed for revealing information out of a statistical database. And we were able to prove that the first work, K-anonymity, turns out not to bound leakage or suppression, and that's what many people have been dissatisfied with that, and they've given ad hoc arguments. Well, we can give this more careful argument. And the improvement, entropy, L diversity, we can tell exactly how many bits of suppression there is. And there's this third thing, differential privacy, which is beautiful, and it doesn't fit into this picture at all. We can't prove that it is suppression. We don't have an information theoretic characterization of why this works. It does something different than the others. It's about comparing databases with you and without you in it, and this is a subject of current research. So I should make a few final comments. The goals I would have for an initiative like this is that the science is informed by real applications, and the stuff that I've talked about today has that property, and I think the stuff that you're going to see from my colleagues all has this property, that it enables engineering. You'd like to think you want engineering first, but I think the science is going to help things. And that the hardest part in doing this science is going to be about asking the right questions. And the best way to convince somebody there are some interesting right questions is to pose some, so here are two. One is, we all believe, Bob started his talk out with that crypto box, that there's a sense in which you can only move stuff around in a system. You can move trust around, but you can't create trust. It'd be great to have a theorem that states that, a conservation principle. It'd be great to have a calculus that lets you work on that. And some of the work that Anupam is going to talk about this morning is in that direction. And the other thing, I see no reason why the kind of science that we do won't have implications in other fields. So the whole business about cancer and HIV is because some mechanism, some defense mechanism in your body runs amok. And you could ask the question, what's the trade-off between the detection capabilities of a mechanism, right, friend or foe, and the aggressiveness of the mechanism, how much does it get to kill, and how is it the case, and I conjecture it is, that any mechanism that's sufficiently powerful necessarily can destroy itself? And that something like HIV is an inevitable consequence of having a sufficiently good immune system or an aggressive defense mechanism, as we're starting to see fielded, that delete pieces of code when they're coming in and so on, can always be made to run amok. So I'd love to pin that down, and actually I've been talking with a biologist at Cornell who's worried about engineering life and talking about if there are some experiments we can do to get a hold on this. So the rest of our talks, you're going to hear four more talks that are specific pieces of work that are science, that are funded under this initiative. These are people who are working as part of trust, and they're examples of the kinds of things that I think we can do, and I feel that the more examples we have, the greater the chances that people will see the wisdom in this approach. So let me turn the podium over to Andrew, who's going to hook a machine up, I guess.